Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today, we speak with Kimby Schultz-Hughes. Kimby is a highly sensitive empath who has her Master of Science in Marriage and Family Therapy and currently specializes in the treatment of children and youth impacted by trauma. She's deeply immersed in her doctorate work in education, where she researches the teachers who teach students impacted by trauma. Additionally, she is an assistant college coach for volleyball and loves being around athletes who, oxymoronically, cause her to feel young and quite old at the same time.
Kimby is also the author of three children's books, which can be found on Amazon: Love Transcends, Love Wins, and Where Peace Lives. You can also find them in the show notes. After thoroughly enjoying the process of working on Where Peace Lives with her children, Kimby and her two kids have another book in progress, so stay tuned. Despite the many hats Kimby wears, being a mama of two highly sensitive kids is undoubtedly the biggest blessing and privilege of Kimby's life. The child in her is deeply healed by them, and she sits in daily awe of their insight, authenticity, kindness, compassion, bravery, and general amazingness. Kimby loves to be active and outdoors, especially with her husband and kids, and feels like life is more sustainable when she approaches it with joy, humor, gratitude, and authenticity.
On today's episode, we discuss Kimby's work with the CBITS program and her work in schools. We also talk about the unique impacts of racial trauma and discrimination on students and children of color. We ask Kimby about her faith journey and its influence on her work and her life in general, and Kimby also talks about the process of writing her three books and how they might help open and facilitate discussions about race. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Kimby, welcome to the podcast. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, before we get started, do you want to share a little bit about yourself to our listeners? Maybe share parts of your personal and professional identities that might be important for them to know about?
Yeah, you know, you gave me a heads up that you'd ask me that, and I'm glad that you did, because I think oftentimes I don't take enough time to reflect on who I am and that personal part of my identity. I'm really used to being in presentations where I say, this is my job title, this is my role, this is what I do, and I'll get to that. But I loved the awareness that I would be asked to reflect on who I am. Mm-hmm. Because so often for me, that gets lost in the shuffle of what I do. So who I am. I'm a highly sensitive person, and I feel like anytime I am given a platform to talk about that, I need to talk about that. It's like my public service announcement to the world on highly sensitive people. I did not discover I was a highly sensitive person until the last decade of my life, and it was the most eye-opening thing for me. So as a highly sensitive person, I'm somebody who feels things in a really big way. I process things deeply. My mind is always making connections. I am an empath, which means that I don't just feel my own big feelings. I feel the big feelings of everybody in the room around me, at times everybody in the world, it feels like. And so it's this constant sort of mindful process for me of figuring out what's mine and what belongs to other people, and how to sort of enter into and live in the space in between without taking on the feelings of the people I'm with or the feelings of the world around me. So I'm a highly sensitive person. That's a big part of my personal identity, and it weaves into everything I do professionally. I'm somebody who really values authenticity. I think I spent a lot of time in my life feeling like I had to have it all together on the outside. Like my professional office is a perfect example of how that still lives out, where I'm like, are all the books organized and are this? And more I see like the clutter creep in my backdrop of like working from home. And it's good for me. Like it's really good for me because I value authenticity. I value it in others. I value it in myself. And yet I continue to fight what it is to have grown up feeling like I need to be all fine and perfect and okay on the outside. So I think authenticity is an important value of mine, and I continue to try and do the work to be brave enough to let the insides and outsides match for myself in that truth, kindness, compassion, social justice. These are things that are really important to me. My faith, spirituality is central to me, though my understanding of it continues to evolve as I move through life and have different experiences. I'm a highly relational person. I'm not sure I realized that until I had children. And I could see that happening in them. And I was like, this is me. Like I really thrive when I'm in relationships and connected with other people. And as a highly sensitive person, become very overwhelmed and exhausted by that at the same time. So it's a process of trying to enter into that part of me without entering so fully that I'm burned out all the time. Being active is really important to me. I love cycling and hiking and playing volleyball and running around and doing obstacle courses that my kids create, and just being physically active, I think, helps me when there's so much energy moving around inside me all the time. Humor is important to me. Sometimes life feels really heavy and serious, and humor gives me a break from that. And gratitude, a practice of gratitude, is what helps me be joyful in all I do and all I experience, even when what I experience is really hard sometimes. So that's me personally. Do you want me to rattle off the professional parts now?
Yeah, all right. Please do.
All right. So first and foremost, I'm a mom. That's like the best job. I hate to call it a job. Like I hear that expression a lot, like being a mom is the best job I've ever had. And I'm like, but it's not, like, it's not really work. Like it is exhausting sometimes, like work, exhausting enough that sometimes I think I like take micro naps while I'm in the shower. So like I'll go to the shower and I have like this downtime, quiet time, and then I lose track of time. And I'm like, was I standing up sleeping? It's possible, because I'm really tired these days, but it's a tired that I wouldn't trade for anything. Like this opportunity to be a mom and to be able to enter into the lives of children who reflect back to me in so many ways, the child in me that still needs healing. It's like this gift. Like, I feel like it's like, if it were work to be a mom, like, I feel like I should be paying my kids for it in some ways, because just by this authentic and genuine and compassionate and, brave way they approach the world, it challenges that child in me to continue healing. So I'm not going to pay my kids for just being my kids, but I'm grateful for the ways that they grow me. So that is a part of my life that is really important to me, despite the fact that I have, I wear a lot of different hats professionally, and I think they all weave together in a lot of ways. So like they're distinct job descriptions. Like I'm a mental health practitioner. I'm the CBITS and community education specialist at Journey Mental Health, which is a local nonprofit, serves the whole county that I'm in. That's one professional hat that I wear. Another professional hat that I wear is as an assistant volleyball coach at Edgewood College. And those may seem really different, right? Coaching and mental health work. But in so many ways, I find my dependable strengths and who God created me to be weave so effortlessly between those two worlds. I'm a researcher right now, doing my doctorate work in education, again, another place where it all kind of weaves together, that gift of mine to seek to understand the experiences of others. I see that happening in research and coaching, in my mental health work. I've been involved in ministry in the past, the director of nonprofit ministries. I've worked supporting adults with developmental disabilities. I was a waitress in college, which truthfully was one of my favorite jobs.
I love the jobs.
Yeah. Love the jobs I have now. If any of my bosses listen to this, love the jobs I have now. I also feel this abundance of overwhelming gratitude to have bosses, to have managers, a head coach, a manager in CBIT's world, who teachers, professors who understand that I have all of these different aspects to me and are supportive of being able to make that work. That is like a gift to me that bring, like, I feel a little teary-eyed because I'm a highly sensitive person. I get teary-eyed about things like this, but I feel a little teary-eyed when I think of that, because each of these things is so important to me, and my family is really important to me. And the only way I can balance all of this is by having leadership around me and above me that, like, the people around me support who I am and are flexible with me and value similar things to what I value. And that's a gift to me. So but yes, the waitress thing was my jam. I did not have the best turn times for tables. I remember them getting on me. Like, the goal is to get people in and out, so they're spending more money in the restaurant. My goal was like, how can I chat with people longer and see what's happening in their lives and learn about them and make connections? And that was wonderful for me as a human. It was not good for the bottom line of the restaurant. But
sure,
that's me.
That's kind of what I picture in my mind when you said you were a waitress. That's exactly how I pictured that going. And I'm sure you were a wonderful waitress. You probably entertained your tables very well.
We had fun.
Kimby, there's so many different directions we could go with this because you do wear so many hats. And I feel like you're in such interesting spaces. So I don't even know where I honestly want to start. But you did mention CBITS. And I myself am a CBITS facilitator right now, working through Catholic Charities. And so I am wondering if you can tell us about that program, because I find it to be extremely beneficial.
Yeah. So CBITS, for anybody who's not familiar with it, is Cognitive Behavioral Intervention for Trauma in Schools. And it is a school-based intervention. It's also, there's an individual component to it in our county. And I don't think this is how it's done everywhere in the nation, but in our area, what we do is we actually utilize a universal screener. So typically, in a typical year — this has not been a typical year for most of us in a lot of ways — but in a typical year, what we would do is we would screen all students in a certain grade level. So sixth grade in some schools do ninth grade or 10th grade. We'd screen all the students in that particular grade level, and we screen for exposure to trauma, symptoms related to traumatic stress or exposure, depression, suicidality. And then as we look at the results of the screener, there are a certain number of students that meet the threshold to receive a mental health interview. And so then school staff and some outside clinicians sit down with those students and go through the screener and evaluate what resources might be helpful for that student, if the student would fit into a CBITS group, and if not, then what. It's also this fantastic opportunity. The interview is, like, probably hands down my favorite part of the whole process, because it's this fantastic opportunity to be able to sit with a student and say, I see you, right? And I hear these hard things that are happening in your life, and I maybe see some of these behaviors that are happening as a response to the hard things, and I see you, and I care about you. And I also see this resiliency and these ways that you're trying to cope. Now, maybe you're asking for help in some ways that aren't very helpful, but wow, that's a resilient thing to be trying to ask for help and having experienced tremendous stress or trauma and being here and sitting here and being willing to talk about it. Like, that's a resilient, brave thing. I think in a lot of ways, I was a student who would have benefited from a program like CBITS, who would have benefited from a screener that caught that I really wasn't okay, like I talked at the start about being okay on the outside, but not so much on the inside. And I wasn't okay on the inside for a lot of childhood. And it would have really mattered to me to have somebody sit down and say, I see you beyond your 4.0, beyond your excelling in athletics, beyond your being fine on the outside. I see your anxiety and your feelings like you don't want to live anymore and your sadness. And I see you and I care about you and I'm here for you. So this program allows the space for that, even if people don't end up in a CBITS group. So the CBITS group itself is based in CBT, and it's a 10-week long session. This year it's been totally revamped to be able to do it virtually, which also required revamping the whole screening process. The screener that we used before, for example, had the CDI-9 asking a question about suicidality in the virtual world to a sixth grader when we don't know their location, when we don't know the supports they have around them. It didn't feel like something we could do safely. So we had to revamp the screener to be able to administer it in a safe way. But one of the gifts in that is that we've also been in this conversation and process of being able to implement more in the screening process to identify stress and trauma related to discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so since it was being revamped this year, we had an opportunity to start entering into that world, and some really neat things have come about as a result of that.
Very cool. Do you want to talk a little bit about the stress and discrimination and Sure. the racial stress that people have been experiencing?
Yeah. So one of the things that we see, and I'm not the expert researcher on this, though I do see a lot of articles that thread into some of the research that I'm doing right now in my doctoral work. But what we know in mental health is that stress and trauma related to discrimination, for example, racism, is a different type of trauma than the one-time car accident. Both are really hard in their own way, but the way that one is experienced is quite different from the other. So when we think of racial and ethnic trauma, it's something that is ongoing. My son, who is a child of color, he has pivotal, like one-time car accident type trauma events related to his racial identity. He also has this ongoing thing where every day I pick him up from school, there's something that he's experienced in the school or in the world that has cut him down in his identity. It's the microaggressions, right, that like add up and add up and add up. And it's this daily process we enter into to continue to separate out what are the messages you're receiving from the outside world that don't need to be internalized because they're mm-hmm. lies and they're based on this historical, large, systemic system of oppression that isn't truth about who you are. And so in the CBITS context, there's this awareness that that's happening, right? And it's complex. There are a number of students who experience racial or discriminatory trauma and also experience other trauma, you know, abuse in the home, or the one-time car accident, or, you know, somebody who's following them in a park, or sexual assault, or there's a host of stuff, right? So it's complex, but we have to start acknowledging the fact that discriminatory trauma is real and is ongoing and looks different, which means that our response to it might need to look different. So one of the things that they're working on nationally with CBITS, and they're in the rollout process with this, is being able to bolster up the CBITS program that's in place to address some of that. And I believe we're still in the process of figuring this out, but I believe we'll get to be trained on being able to administer that. We also have this really amazing thing happening in our program where we have some doctoral students who have developed, it's based on a program that was developed elsewhere, but it's the HEART program, and it's Healing Ethnic and Racial Trauma. And they did a pilot group this year in the community. And these doctoral students are just, and I think there's one master's level student involved in it. I mean, they're fantastic. They are fantastic and have put together this amazing program, and it has gotten traction. And now we're in the process of, in a couple weeks, piloting it within a school. And so we're building a team around this, and our hope is to be able to offer that in the future as kind of another option to be able to support trauma in the schools. And it's really important, I think, that we have options, right? Because one treatment approach isn't right for all people or all experiences or everything. And we see that in psychology all the time, right? So many of us have different theoretical orientations, different approaches. There needs to be variance.
Kimby, can you speak to the importance of this going on within the educational system, not so much in the community or in like a private practice or even community mm-hmm. mental health setting? Can you speak to the importance of this actually happening at the school?
The mental health program itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for that question, Carly. That's actually part of why I got into this work in the first place. One of the things that I see is that mental health care is in a lot of ways not affordable. It's not accessible. It's highly stigmatized. And this breaks down those barriers in a profound way. We don't ask students to come to us. We physically go into the school. Well, when we could physically go into a school, but again, we will physically go into a school someday. And now we physically enter into the school space during their synchronous class time. We go into the school and we provide intervention and support there. So it removes that barrier of having to get someplace else or being on a wait list or having to find an insurance that matches up. Or if you don't have insurance, finding a place that has a sliding fee scale that can take you. It reduces those barriers. One of the other things that we're really intentional about in the program is, you know, trauma is built right into the title of the program, but we are really intentional about the process being framed in a way that it is a screener and a mental health interview. It is not a formal assessment. We are not mm-hmm. giving a diagnosis. Our goal is really to identify what's happened in the lives of students, what's happening in the lives of students, and how we build up support around that in their environment and out in the world. So that ability to go and enter in physically into their space and not ask them to come to us is amazing. I think also I see it destigmatize mental health just in the sense that it's something we talk about at school. If we're talking about it here, if I have my school people who are understanding it, if my teachers are starting to get some common language around this, it removes that barrier of there must be something wrong with me. And so I need to go to this special place. Now, I know a lot of people who work in private practice world. I know a lot of people at Journey who work in outpatient world. There's nothing wrong with that world. I want to be clear about that. There's nothing wrong with that world. I just feel a sense of call to being able to meet students where they're at. Yeah. So that's, I think, one of the things that's really important to me. I think it helps with access. I think it helps with equity. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important work.
Absolutely. As a former high school English teacher, I would have, pardon my language, but I would have killed to have mm-hmm. a program like that for my students mm-hmm. because I felt like a lot of the times what I was doing as a teacher, and this was before I was trained as a therapist, is I was trying to figure out how to support students who are going through really traumatic things.
Right.
And I didn't even know how to do that. And so to have this kind of program and to have actual trained professionals come into the school, it's a game changer.
Right. And I see the importance of the teachers, and I think that's where my heart was compelled to enter into education for my doctoral work, because I see when we get out of our silos and we operate in a way of proactive collaboration, better things happen for the people that we have a shared heart to serve. And I see what matters for students when they have a teacher who gets it, you know, and built into the CBITS program, we have teacher sessions where teachers can come and learn more about the curriculum and how to support students in their classroom. And it's a really powerful thing when I see staff within a school beyond the direct services or student support services people, when I see staff beyond that, really get involved in the program and develop this sort of whole school model for supporting stress and trauma, it really matters for students. And I think it matters for them, right? Because we see this really high rate of burnout mm-hmm. amongst teachers who are experiencing secondary traumatic stress. And so it's this awareness that healing isn't individual work, despite our individualistic nature in our culture in America, in our dominant culture in America. Despite that, healing work, to me, best happens when we're collaborative. It best happens when we understand our own need for healing within the context of helping others. So that whole school model, I think, is fantastic.
Absolutely. That's part of the reason I left the education system, unfortunately, is because of some of that vicarious trauma. And I just felt spread so thin. Mm-hmm. It was not something that I could sustain long term.
Yeah.
I have so many questions for you, Kimby. I am wondering if you could speak a little bit about it. I hope it's okay to pivot a little bit. If you could speak a mm-hmm. little bit about how your faith and your spirituality plays into the kind of work that you do, or even just how it impacts your personal life, whatever you're willing to share about that.
Yeah, my faith is tremendously important to me. And I think in that is this connectedness to something more than myself. I think as somebody who has dipped her toe in the academic world for a long time, there's a lot about academia that I struggle with and I don't like. But learning and growing, that I love. And so I feel like for me, when I'm in the academic world, when things can get very heady, right? And like I'm all just reading a ton of articles and figuring it out and making these connections and trying to cognitively think about what's best, there's a limit to that. Because no matter how much I read, no matter how much I shove in my brain, I am human and there's a limit to me. But in my faith, I'm connected to something bigger than myself. And so a big part of my faith practice is finding ways to get out of my head and down into my heart. And so I weave it in to all aspects of myself. You know, it's interesting. We just played our first volleyball match against another team in a year. We had our 1 year anniversary of being shut down from COVID recently, and to see college athletes play against each other in this like odd way where you don't shake hands and you wave from across the gym. And but to sit in like the privilege of being able to do that safely, was a profound thing. But I remember there was a player that came in at the end of a game in a really tough situation, came in to serve game point for the other team. And I was squatting down in my like typical coach focused squat. And I found myself praying for her. And it wasn't praying that like the serve would go in or that, you know, I mean, that may be like the hope, right? For some people or right. Like, sure, I hope the serve goes in. Sure, I hope she's able to put the serve in. But my prayer for her was, I hope she knows how wonderful and lovable she is, no matter what happens with this ball. And I find that my faith is what sustains me in the times that I can get caught up being concerned with the outcome or being concerned with performance or being concerned with what others think or don't think about me. It's my faith that kind of grounds me in that place of saying, you know, I am loved and accepted as I am. And the same is true of that player. Whether that ball went in the net, I know she would have felt sad about that. That's not how she thought that would have turned out. It didn't go in the net. But even if it had, she's loved and accepted as she is. And I see that in every part of my life, that ability to hold a space for a student without judgment of them, but acceptance that they are doing the best that they can right now. All of us are, right? And I can apply that really easily to other mm-hmm. people. Applying it to myself is a little harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I see that aspect of my faith. I see it when I take a step back and I look at my life and I think, I had come up with some pretty amazing plans in my head about what my professional trajectory should look like. It does not look anything like I thought it did.
Right.
Back when I first met the two of you, it doesn't look anything like I thought it would 10 years ago. And yet I am so keenly aware that I am exactly where I am supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And every part of that process, I was as well, right? I didn't make a mistake going to the school I went to before. I didn't make a mistake. It's all purposeful, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's all used for something. And I don't always understand it. But I think even the hard stuff is redeemed and it's used and it continues to connect me to a story that's way bigger than myself. And my faith is important to me in that way.
I don't think I ever shared this with you, Kimby, but you know, before I started graduate school and I met you, we briefly went to the same school together. Carly was also at that same school with us. Mm-hmm. Before I met you, I was in a space where I was detaching myself from my faith tradition. I grew up in a very religious household, and so I really tried to distance myself from that. And you were one of the first people who made me reconsider what my own faith could look like. Because you were so open and honest, and you were so, like you said, you value authenticity. You were so authentically yourself. And that was the first time I saw anybody speak about social justice and their faith in the same sentence. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was like absolutely mind-blowing. And I was like, wow, maybe there is a different way to do this thing. Yeah. So I feel like I'm at a place right now in my spiritual journey, in part thanks to you and thanks to just the mm-hmm. openness that you have, and the compassion and the love that I mean, this might be weird to say, but in your presence, I do feel like somebody who is seen and loved. And I think you just emulate that to a lot of people.
I appreciate that affirmation, Laura. And I also completely get what you're saying. For me, it has been a journey of, I identify within a particular religion, but in many ways, it's been a journey of divorcing myself from the religion and remarrying my relationship yeah. with a higher power, my relationship with God. I think in a lot of ways, right? Like, I know you both value authenticity and truthfulness. And so I'll be honest, it's hard for me to identify as Christian mm-hmm. right now in a lot of yeah. ways, because I feel so much shame for what I see other people doing in the name of the faith that I identify as a yep. part of. And it's painful. And yet I know for me, that's my understanding of my higher power. And that's what works for me. And that's where I'm at. That's the truth that's on my heart. I don't expect that to be or need that to be the truth that's on anybody else's heart. One of the most powerful opportunities I had in undergrad was being a part of an Abrahamic Religions Forum, where I sat with Jewish people, Muslim people, and Christian people. And we shared about our faiths, and we came to find common understanding amongst those Abrahamic religions. And one of the things I walked away from there realizing was, oh my goodness, I have way more in common with a liberal Muslim person or a liberal Jewish person than I do with a conservative Christian person.
Yeah.
I identify as Christian, but we do not see eye to eye on a lot of these things. And so I think that a lot of it for me has been trying to remove sort of those man, or see, there's like my microaggression, really trying hard to get out of saying you guys and mm-hmm. man-made things.
Yep.
The kids are holding me accountable to that. My children are, and I'm so grateful for that. But these human-made things, these human-made categories that we have come up with, and religion is one of those, right? Like, religion is human-made.
Yep.
Faith, spirituality, that's bigger than me. Mm-hmm. And I can orient myself within a particular religion that kind of serves as my vehicle for driving my faith process. But that religion cannot be, for me, that religion cannot be my God. My God has to be my God. Mm-hmm. So what you are saying makes sense to me, because it's a process that I have experienced as well.
Thanks so much for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we can pivot again. because we do want to ask you about your books. You're an author.
Yeah. Before we do that though, when you say pivot, I have to tell you, I don't know if any of you ever watched Friends, but my husband and I watched Friends back when we were first dating. Like we watched through all 10 seasons. And there's an episode where Ross pivots a couch up some stairs. And it's like a running joke in our home. Anytime we move something, like we're like, pivot, pivot. And every time you say that, like, it's a fantastic word and I like to pivot. And I am like so sleep deprived, I think, that all I hear is Ross in my head saying, pivot. And I'm like, yes, I will get in pivot the couch position. But let's pivot. Yes, let's pivot. Because I do too want to talk about the book. So I'm sorry I interrupted your question.
No, that's great. I am so sorry that that's going on in your mind because that must be so distracting.
It's like wonderful too because I'm like, oh, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. No, we're so curious about your identity as an author and the books you've written, and you actually involve your children in the books you write. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I've self-published 3 books. It is totally a family affair. Couldn't do it without my husband. Like the computer world, technology world stresses me right out, which like welcome to 2020, 2021. Like get on board, Kimby. And I'm figuring it out, navigating it. But the creative process of waking up at 1 a.m. with words that God's laid on my heart and scribbling them on like the backs of Kleenex boxes is how most of the books come to be. And then eventually put in a layout and it's all done on paper. And then I'm like, all right, my husband, Nick, how do you put this into something that other people can read on a computer that goes by? So he has been such a blessing for me in that regard. The first book I wrote was Love Transcends. And that very much was my son's story as he wrestled with transracial adoption. So I wrote a poem. He was dealing with a lot of stuff in preschool where people didn't identify me as his mom. And it was hard and it was painful. And he would say, no, that's my mama. And they say, no, she's not. She's not. She doesn't look like you. She's not your mama. And well, I could understand as an adult that these are 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, like 3-4-year-olds that are just categorizing the world around them and trying to make meaning of it. And it's not, I'm not like 3-year-old, you should know better, but also we need an opportunity to learn better, right? To be able to enter into conversations that not all families look the same. And I think that that is something that early childhood teachers, I know, some of them do it really, really well. And some of them don't engage it quite as much. And some don't even know that it's something they need to engage. And so I'd written this poem and shared it with my kid's preschool teacher who still, my kids are 7, pushing 8. And this teacher, still in touch with her. She has mattered so much to my family. She encouraged me. She said, you should put this in a book because this is something that I would use to talk with families, to talk with students, to be able to have another resource, to be able to talk about transracial adoption. And I felt nervous about that, but I trusted her. And then she said, and you should use pictures of your own family. And then I felt really nervous about that because body image and self-identity are things that it was in the healing process from. Felt really nervous about like, would they be able to actually capture my family as my family, or are we supposed to look fine or happy or whatever? And that didn't work very well for me because I was, again, in this healing process of like my insides and outsides need to match. And so we ended up working with our wedding photographers because they were authentic people and they just came and spent a couple weekends with us, followed us around and took pictures of our family being our family, doing the things that we do. So that's how that book came to be. And it really, the hope for that book is that it's a place where, where Elijah can stand up for his story and feel fully embraced in the beauty of his difference while also finding a sense of belonging and connection within his family. Still, after the book, there have been traumatic incidents for Elijah where, for example, we were at a baseball game, professional baseball game, and a white woman came up. We were walking to our seats, and a white woman came up and grabbed my son's hand and pulled him away from our family and brought him over to a black family that was standing like at a concession stand and said, "Oh no, honey, I've got him. I found him. I found him." And my husband right away, you know, went over, and my son was crying, and he said, "This is my son." And he said, "Oh," and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought he belonged to that family. I thought you were trying to take him. I mean, you can understand. I was trying to help him." And it was just so painful and hard. And I saw her get angry at us for our anger. And it's things like that where he, you know, things, smaller things where he is in the library, and like we go to a public library together, and somebody says, "Now, are you his babysitter?" You know, and every time he hears those things, it matters to him and it matters to me. So this book, in some ways, was his opportunity to say, "This is my family. And I know I don't look like them, and it's beautiful, and it's my family." I think it's also been an opportunity for us personally to be able to talk about those things that are sad and hard, and to let ourselves feel angry about it, like to allow ourselves, and back to the faith piece. Like, when I was young, I saw Jesus as like a cool white dude with long hair walking in Birkenstocks. That is not how I see Jesus now. That is not the skin color that I see on Jesus now. That is not the shoe style I see on Jesus now. And I also don't see him as somebody who was just walking around passively, right? Like, I understand Jesus as the Jesus who was in the temple and through the tables, because Jesus was angry at the injustice that happened. And I think books like this allow that opportunity for us to, again, faith weaves into everything we do, but to let ourselves not just feel scared about those times, but to feel angry that he has to live in a world where at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, he's constantly having to stand up for himself to adults in a way that he shouldn't have to. The second book we did was Love Wins, and that was based on the Haitian proverb, "The rock in the water has no idea how the rock in the sun must suffer." I heard that proverb from an Africology teacher in undergrad, and it has stuck with me. It has always stuck with me. And the hope in that book is that it's just a tool for early childhood educators and even adults. When I read it with adults, that it's a tool for us to be able to have conversations about privilege and positionality. Because what I find is that kids really are quite comfortable talking about those things. It's us adults who are like nervous about it, right? Especially white adults who have like the white fragility thing going on, where they like don't want to enter into reading the book or talking about it because they don't want to say the wrong thing. And kids, every time I've read those books with kids, they're just wanting to talk about it, wanting to learn about it, and doing so without judgment. And then the last book we did was Where Peace Lives. And that came out of a place of spending a lot of late nights just holding a space for the worries in my kids' lives. They are two highly sensitive children. Both of them have experienced adverse childhood experiences, have experienced traumatic experiences at different points. And this was a way that they had sort of already started entering into the healing and the coping. They would draw their own pictures. We would talk about their pictures. And as we continue to do that, it was like, I think this is something that might be beneficial to other students. It was done before the COVID times. We just didn't get it out until the COVID times because COVID happened. But I think it's one of those God things where that book came out at exactly the right time, because I think it was a time where there were a lot of us in the world who collectively needed the ability to know that feelings don't last forever, and that there is a peace that is inside of us, that when we can find our way there, it sustains us until the big feelings pass. So that book was so much fun to get to work on with the kids. And yeah, there's another one in the works right now that they're working on. And I think it gives them a voice in a way that kids deserve and don't have in our society.
Mm-hmm. Kimby, I'm really curious. I know this is a little bit off topic and we certainly do not have to cover this if you're not comfortable talking about it or if we just run out of time. I'm curious about your transition from mental health counseling or just counseling in general to the essentially a department of education. And I'm curious about that journey and what it might look like now. I don't know much about getting a PhD in education. So yeah. I would love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the program that I'm a part of is focused on educational leadership, and I'm in the higher ed track, which is interesting because my research and my focus is in the K-12 world, but I'm not in the K-12 track of doctoral work. So that would be like the superintendent type track. So my work is fascinating to me because I'm around people who are doing all sorts of different things in education. Interestingly enough, there are a number of them who overlap with mental health. So there seems to be some sort of synergy happening in our society right now, where there are a number of cohort members who are also looking at social, emotional, or mental health related things in their research. There are some, Laura, I actually think of you often with this. There is a teacher who taught in K-12 and left and now is in higher education and is teaching other teachers. But as I hear her story, I'm reminded a bit of yours. So it's interesting. It's not anything I ever thought it would be. I knew people who did their doctorate work in education, and I don't think I ever really understood what that was until I felt the sense of calling to leave the doctorate work in psychology and talk to a friend who had just done her master's work in education. So I don't really have a good answer for you, Carly, of what it is as much as it's what you make it. Like, I see people researching in different disciplines within education. The program I'm a part of is one that is really focused on leadership and how whatever discipline we're in, how we become leaders within it to move it forward. It's also a program that has a really heavy focus on equity, on social justice. And it is completely refreshing to me to be in a program where those conversations are woven into every class, right? Like, I'm in inclusive leadership right now. And that's like the specific, like, you know, every graduate program has like their diversity class. This inclusive leadership class is fantastic. Love it. And also the things we talk about here have been woven into every single class I've had. There hasn't been one class where we haven't been talking about this stuff, the same stuff we're talking about in inclusive leadership. And one of my challenges with higher education is from a diversity and inclusion and equity and social justice standpoint, is there are often within programs the one core requirement for taking a diversity class. And if you try and bring it up anywhere else, it's like, oh, you'll talk about that in diversity. You'll talk about that in diversity. It shouldn't be that way, right? Like, this needs to be a part of all of the curriculum. I'm lucky to be a part of a program where that's happening. That's also my hope in higher education, is to be able to implement not only those inclusion, equity, social justice, diversity type things, but also the mental health stuff into other disciplines, right? Like, I think I see in education, we really do operate in silos in a lot of ways. And it's the way the traditional American education system has oriented itself. And it's not the way that I personally orient myself. And I don't think that it's a benefit to any of our disciplines to be so siloed. And so I would love to see classes about social emotional well-being or mental health embedded into all sorts of places, like whether that's medical school or pre-med stuff or even business schools. I think about when my husband in the like business world, when they had a colleague who died pretty suddenly from cancer, a young colleague, and like the company didn't know what to do, right? And it's because unless there were people there who had been on their own journey of healing or mental health recovery, this was like, we don't know how to wrap our minds around this. Like, I think all of us could benefit from being able to take mental health as like this elitist thing that you go to if you have money or privilege, and make it something that we just talk about, that we normalize. That's a part of recognizing these are things that happen for all of us at different points in our lives, whether or not we slap a label on it or not. We all deal with hard stuff at some point in life. We all deal with changes in systems, right? Like in family systems, the orientation, I'm a marriage and family therapy trained person. We would say the hardest time in a system is the addition or loss of a member. Every place you're in is going to deal with that, right? Every workplace, every environment. So how are we preparing people through higher education to be able to navigate that in whatever discipline they end up in? So, I don't really know what a doctorate in education is besides what I'm doing with it, Carly, but I highly recommend it. I mean, it's been fantastic for me. And I think our education system is broken from start to end in a lot of ways in this country. And I can't fix it alone, but I certainly want to be a part of the group that is working to undo some of the damage. You know, I see it happening to my kids. Their first grade. And I see the daily unlearning that has to happen from the way the traditional American education is oriented. And I see teachers getting lost in the mix of it and burned out, and it's not working very well for a lot of people. So that's where I'm at with that.
Kimby, you do incredible work. You really do. And I think our community is blessed to have you. I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts or any final things you want to share with our listeners.
Yeah. Thank you. If you've stuck with us to this point for listening to me ramble. I guess the final thought I have is take what you like and leave the rest. I work a recovery program. We say that a lot there. Mm-hmm. And take what you like and leave the rest. I am an expert on my experience. I'm not an expert on all things. I'm not an expert on a lot of things. I'm just an expert on my life and what I'm learning. And honestly, if you interview me again in 10 years, I'll probably look back and say, wow, I wish I had known then what I know now. Mm-hmm. Because that's the nature of engaging the process of being a wounded healer, right? So I guess the last thought is, here's me today. And take what you like and leave the rest. And thank you both for the privilege of just being able to talk about things that are important to me and for making it so safe to just be me in this hour, but always and in my life. So thank you.
I do have a follow-up with something that you said, Kimby, and I love your optimism when you say that you're an expert of your own experience, because I certainly am not at all an expert of my own experience.
I think you are, though, right? Like, you know you better. You may that's not true. Understand it. I don't understand it, right? But that's the, like, oh, man, like, I could use a Cliff Notes version in my mind of being the expert on, but my heart, right? Like, I know my heart.
Yeah.
You know, and you do too, right? Like you are the only one who knows Carly.
That's true.
And you're stuck with you every day. That's very true. I'm like, man, I got to shore up this being able to love myself and have compassion for myself and stop trying to like perfect the process of healing from imperfection, because I'm with me all the time, right? Like, you have a friend you don't like, you can say, let's pause this friendship. Mm-hmm. I'm with me all the time. So like, get on board, Kimby, you know, like self-compassion, learning to love myself. Like that's a full-time job, and it's a job worth having, because I'm stuck with me, and I'm an okay person to be stuck with, I think. At least that's how I'm going to see it today.
We think you're great, Kimby. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for your time and your wisdom. We really appreciate you.
Sounds good. Thank you.